saying that, you know, we're not going to be good or we don't have the talent, but we know that we have the confidence in the guys to do it. So it's going to be a fun season, proving people wrong again.
Coming to you live from the Elliott Avenue Studios, this is the 12th Man Roundtable.
Every day we're spotting guys in different places to make sure that they get their opportunities to show what they can do so we can keep it as competitive as possible.
Brought to you by Carpet Liquidators, locally owned and operated since 1988 with 6 Western Washington locations. The 12th Man Roundtable with Greg Bell of the Tacoma News Tribune, KJR beat reporter Curtis Crabtree, and KJR's Hugh Millen on your home for the 12th man in the NFL, Seattle Sports Radio 950, KJR.
It's called parallax, Bucky, parallax. Now, I have no idea if it fits my argument or yours, but Hugh Millen wanted to let me know that it's parallax, not optics, that can fool the eye.
Okay.
On a fly ball into the stands.
Okay.
Again, I don't know if he's saying I'm wrong and you're right, or you're wrong and I'm right, but it
I
is.
Don't either.
No, I didn't say optics is the wrong way to put it, because it is optics. I think parallax is a more a subset of a broader range of optics.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
No. But then again, 9 and 8 play some really loud music.
You could describe optics about a wide array of things.
Yeah.
Including a parallax. A parallax is a little tiny subdivision of optics.
You parallax gotta hear the carjack story.
Parallax is how the direction or position of an object appears to differ based on different positions.
Different perspectives. Yeah. Different angles of the camera.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I don't know. Again, I'm not sure if he's...
Well, I don't know what it states either. I'm pretty sure I'm right.
Okay. All right, well, we are going to dive
off
into
air
the
stuff
Ocho.
That came on, dude.
Yes.
By the way,
we like to do
all
that.
All good.
8 stories in 8 minutes. This time, all about the Seahawks. We have Hugh Millen here. We have our reporter, Curtis Crabtree, here. And we have our Seahawks insider, Greg Bell. Look at him.
London G.
Look at him. Did you at any time speak in the accent? Just slip up and sleep and
of
speak?
Course.
Okay.
Aluminium. Of course, mate.
All right, well, let's get things going.
You guys are blokes.
Yeah, we've got 8 stories in 8 minutes to get to, and obviously the big story this week with the Seahawks is a sad one. Owner Paul Allen passing away this week at the age of 65. I've talked to Greg about this week. Hugh, I've talked to Curtis about this week. We haven't heard from on this particular topic, and so I'll just open it up, wide range, wherever you want to go with it, just your thoughts on Paul Allen and his time with the Seahawks.
Well, it really hit me hard, and I listened to a lot of the commentary, and I don't know how I could add to so much of what I heard. I mean, Mike Gastineau, Dave Bowling, many others, I don't want to exclude anybody. I thought they were very eloquent in their descriptions and just kind of remembering of him. I guess as I was presented with this, the only thing that I could offer would be maybe my experience in the NFL. Quickly went to the Rams, got drafted the Rams first. Georgia Frontieri was the owner. The players just kind of mocked her. One time we had, for the team photo, we had to wait for an hour for her to get down from the limo from L.A. And in a totally breathless sunny day in September in Orange County, some guy had to hold an umbrella, a plastic umbrella that had like a dome umbrella to walk out so that her hair didn't get ruffled by the wind that was non-existent. So we waited for an hour for the team photo for this. Then I go to the Falcons. Rankin Smith, some insurance guy, I mean, the players literally called them the Clamplets, like Jethro. Like each one of the Smith family had a name from the players. You know, Jethro and Jed and all this, like they were the Clampets. Go up to New England, and James Bush Orthwine, you know, was a Bush guy. Kind of non-existent, but when he was around, he just seemed to be drunk. And then I went to Dallas, and Jerry Jones, we all kind of know how he meddles. Yeah. Hey, bright guy, driven guy, a lot of respect there, but, you know, kind of oppressive to the coaches. It wasn't until I was in Denver where Pat Bowlen, where I felt like I actually was on a team that the owner just kind of was the way a guy should be as an owner. That's just some impressions. So when you think of what Paul Allen's done for the city and what a brilliant owner he was in the sense of you know, everything goes through his said set. So he hires everybody who hires everybody, yeah. right? So if you have success in the franchise, it goes straight to the top. So I could talk longer, but I think others have said it far better than me. It's a tremendous loss.
Yeah, and as good an owner as you're going to find
yeah.
In the sports world. And we will talk a little bit more about it later on. Greg, I will just ask you the nuts and bolts of this, kind of removing ourselves from the emotions of it. What's your feel for the future of the franchise and how it will proceed without Paul Allen at the helm?
Well, Jody Allen is the vice chairman of First and Goal Incorporated, which is Paul Allen's football company he formed when he bought the Seahawks in 1996 from Ken Behring. I cannot imagine that Paul Allen and Jody Allen did not have a discussion about succession after this was Paul Allen's third bout with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
He'd beaten the previous two. So in the short term, it is a natural progression for Jody Allen to take a more visible and active ownership role in the franchise at the top of it and to follow what Paul Allen did, which was to let the football guys do the football things and be the opposite of the owners that Hugh just outlined. And that's what made the Seahawks relationship between Paul Allen and the football staff so great for the football staff is he let the football guys run the football team. I don't see them selling. I don't see that Paul Allen told Jody Allen, I don't know this firsthand, but just knowing how the organization has been running for the last 22 years, I don't see all of a sudden Paul Allen saying, you do whatever you want to do with it, Jody, fine. You want to sell it? You want to do this? I don't see that. I've been told that she is more interested in the Seahawks than in the other properties that Paul Allen owns, namely the Portland Trailblazers
mm-hmm.
and perhaps the stake in the Seattle Sounders, that the Seahawks are the most likely of those three franchises to remain Jody Allen's property and stay in the Allen family. I'm not ruling out a possibility of a sale, but I think everything's in place for it to stay in the Allen family as of right yeah. now.
Curtis, I mean, there are more important things here than a game in Detroit in a week and a half, obviously, and there's never a good time for tragedy. That being said, you do have a bye week here to deal with an awful lot of stuff if you're the Seattle Seahawks, including returning from London. So bye week coming at a good time?
Yeah, I mean, I think regardless of this particular circumstance, I think there's always the conversation every year, is the bye week coming at a good time? Unless you're talking like week four or something really, really early, I don't think it matters all that much. Ultimately, in this particular circumstance, the fact that they don't need to have a divisional matchup against the 49ers or Cardinals or Rams coming back home this weekend after all of that and then trying to play a game with that looming over everything. I mean, not that it necessarily couldn't be done, but it's something you don't have to worry about in the immediate aftermath of that. So you can kind of regroup and figure out where you're moving, have a plan for everything, and not feel like you're trying to wedge this into all your other stuff you're trying to do.
Greg, it does give you a chance to heal up what injuries you have. We talked with you last hour, and good news on the KJ Wright front, should be just enough time to get him back on the football field.
Right, and that was the idea behind not returning, making his season debut from the knee surgery in London to give him not only the London week off, but also the bye week. I think really good was the quote that Pete Carroll had on Tuesday or whatever day that was. I don't know what day it is right now. he says that KJ's had a couple really good days. We think he's on track for getting back to competing at practice. He'll practice with us and compete to play next week when we return. Now, compete to play really just means is his knee ready to go. I mean, he's the best weak side linebacker they've had in the last 10 years. Obviously, he's a Pro Bowler. So if he's healthy enough to play, he will. Ed Dixon returning and debuting may be the more impactful for the short term because they don't have a tight end of any experience on the roster anymore. Will Disley, the promising rookie's on injured reserve. Ed Dixon's eligible to come off the non-football injury list against Detroit on the 28th. He had to miss the first 6 weeks of the regular season when you're on NFI. They don't even know what they have in him. He was a blocking tight end in Carolina behind Greg Olsen as the pass catcher. Became a pass catcher last year when Greg Olsen got hurt. They signed Ed Dixon to a 3-year deal, easily cuttable after this year. But a 3-year deal that suggests he should be the number one tight end, and we're finally going to see, it appears, on October 28th, what Ed Dixon looks like at tight end.
Hugh, Frank Clark had a Defensive Player of the Year kind of week in London against the Raiders. And now, Joel Corey, super agent turned media member, says that get used to pass rushers making $20 million per year, and Frank Clark could be one of those guys. I mean, does Frank Clark really go that quickly to that kind of a financial stratosphere based on the way he's playing right now?
Well, I think that we've long since stopped being shocked by how these salaries are escalating. And it certainly could happen. I look at the defensive ends. There's 15 guys making $10 million a year or more right now. Calais Campbell, from a cap value at 17.5, is the highest. There are five guys over $15 million. That's not counting Khalil Mack
Aaron Donald.
Yeah. Or Von Miller.
Yeah.
Because they're linebackers and interior players. And Frank Clark will be judged as a defensive end, but he'll also be judged with Von Miller and Khalil Mack if you talk about impact that way. So it's a little bit hard to get some of the comparables, but the salary cap is going to continue to go up. So it would not shock me a bit if at some year in his next contract he's at $20 million.
If he goes to free agency, someone's going to overpay him.
Yes.
And that's why the urgency to have to re-sign him before March, because all bets are off if you let a pass rusher at age 25 with his production the last 3 years go to free agency.
Yeah, no question. Curtis, hot and cold the pass rush so far. We've had a game in which they've sacked the quarterback 6 times. We've had a game in which they've sacked the quarterback 5 times. And then we've had 4 games where we've come back on Monday and said, where was the pass rush? So is this a strength or a weakness at this point?
I think on the aggregate, it's probably still a weakness. Frank has had a terrific first 6 weeks of the year. Jaron Reed's probably given you a little bit more from a sack production standpoint than you may have anticipated. But that 6-sack game against an Oakland offensive line that was terrible last Sunday, I think it's going to color a lot of the numbers that they have at this point. Frank, you knew, was going to be okay. And, you know, despite his illness that he'd had, the food poisoning in the one game a week ago, and then whatever forced him to miss the last, you know, quarter and change of the game in London, he could have ended up with 2 or 3 more sacks with the way he was abusing Colton Miller in that one. So, but on the aggregate over 6 weeks, it's still probably less consistent production than you would prefer at this point in time.
10 sacks going into the London game, 29th in the league in sacks per pass play before the London game, and then the Oakland Raiders showed up.
Hugh, what about this offense? We reached the bye week, 3-3 record, and there's been a new identity for the last 4 weeks. We've talked with Coach Holmgren in the past. He's not sure it's sustainable for 16 games against some of the competition they're going to have to play down the stretch, but they're pretty married to this identity that they've created in the last 4 weeks, don't you think?
Yeah, I think the music bed tells me that I can't get into too much detail, but I think it's what we've all been seeing, that there has been a transformation. I think all of us that I've heard were commenting in week 1 and 2. I don't know that anybody's beat the drum louder than Greg Bell on this topic, and he's being proven right, as all of us are. It seemed so obvious at the time that they talked so much about what they wanted to do philosophically, and then they just didn't do it. They just didn't execute it in week 1 and 2. And so I think this, Fluker's healthier than he appeared in training camp.
Yep.
Jermaine Ifedi has had a remarkable, I don't say remarkable, he's had a borderline startling transformation, how much better he is, and I think that's because of Fluker. That J.R. Sweezy at left guard has been kind of what you hope to get from Posick.
Mm-hmm.
And the other two pieces you counted on. But I think that right side is benefiting from Fluker's leadership. Obviously, Fluker himself is an inspired player, but I think he's inspiring a physicality and an accountability from Jermaine Ifedi.
All right, final item, 8th item. Curtis, most important thing, Slick Hawk is engaged. Your reaction?
Good luck to her. No, congratulations to Slick.
Give it up to Matt for the setting, huh?
Yeah, about that. Yeah.
Oh, man. The Eiffel Tower in the background. The
Should he get married in the Slick Hawk uniform? Or
not after a setting of an engagement like that. Uh-huh. He's setting her up for some high class. That was impressive.
This is the pinnacle of it. this is to allow the CenturyLink Field Slick Hawk jerseyed out wedding. That's what it's going for.
Yeah, just don't do it at a halftime of a Seahawk game, or worse yet, during a TV timeout of a kickoff or something.
Sure, that's already scheduled.
All right, we will expand on some of these topics and maybe a couple of other ones as we continue with our 12-man roundtable. Sports Radio 950 KJR.
Now back to the 12th Man Roundtable, brought to you by Carpet Liquidators on Seattle's original diehard sports station. Sports Radio 950, KJR.
Back in the morning, Sports Radio 950 KJR, and it is Thursday, so we brought in our titans of the industry. Greg Bell, Curtis Crabtree, Hugh Mellon to talk some Seahawks, a little 12th man roundtable for you here. And we've gone through what I feel are the eight top stories of the week, including Slick Hawk's engagement. But now we get to expand a little bit on some of this stuff. I'll go to you first, Greg. You were the one that actually experienced the football in London for the Seattle Seahawks, and give us a little thumbnail sketch of everything that you thought it was or wasn't.
It was fabulous.
Yeah.
The great trip. The Seahawks loved where they were out in the countryside. They were about 30 miles outside the city of London in a town called Watford. And it had a link-style golf resort. They practiced there. It's where the England national footy team practices before they play games at Wembley. And they were treated like royalty out there. There were international, European media crews running all over the place for them. The Seahawks fandom in London surprised me. I think it surprised the players as well. There is a large segment of Europeans that were not just Pacific Northwesterners, Europeans who came from Germany and Switzerland and Italy and that were there at that game. And I met people from Scotland, a guy who had spent almost his life savings to attend that game with his son. He couldn't believe the fortune of the Seahawks at one of his favorite teams being in London to play. I think some of the English fervor over the Seahawks stems from them being in back-to-back Super Bowls, and they were in the primetime featured games. In Europe, you get maybe one or two or three. In the case of the United Kingdom, Sky Sports plays four games, NFL games, each weekend on television in the middle of the night there. And those games are the featured games of the week, and the Seahawks for the last 5, 6, 7 years were the featured team in many of those games, so I think that's where a lot of the fandom comes as well. That stadium had 85,000 people in it, completely packed. I didn't see an empty seat. It was supposed to be a Raiders home game. They played the Raiders songs and the Raiders PR person and all that, yet they got booed by the Wembley Stadium crowd. You could feel the history inside the stadium. I know it's rebuilt from studs from the original Wembley, but the banners in the stadium, there are murals in the concourses depicting the famous events at the Live Aid concert in 1985, a Nelson Mandela tribute, the 1948 Olympics. It's like the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum of the UK, and you could just feel it by walking into the building. Mm-hmm. Not to mention, personally, I love the European-style press box that's in the middle of the stands out in the first deck rather than behind closed of glass. You're actually in the stadium inside. It was raining. We had our overcoats on. The whole entire event, I think, exceeded the Seahawks' expectations. Then, of course, winning by 24 points sure helped it make him feel like it was a better experience. But
yeah, couldn't have gone better.
Couldn't have gone better. To a man, everyone I spoke to in the locker room after the game said they would love to come back. They would love for an NFL team to be there. The logistics of which they said they have to have a bye week. Body-wise, just personally, it is not so bad flying home. I left at 2 p.m. London time yesterday at Heathrow, got to Vancouver at 3:30. So you leave in the mid-afternoon and get here in the mid-afternoon. It's like flying across our country. Body-wise, it feels that way to you time-wise. But going over, that took a while. And the players talked about how 9.5-hour flight across 8 time zones and leaving on Wednesday evening around dinner time and getting there Thursday morning affected them. The Raiders came in on Friday, and I can't help.
They looked affected.
I can't help but think that affected them. I mean, they're a bad team anyway.
Yeah.
And that bad team got worse by flying in 36 hours before the game. The Seahawks said it took them a couple days body-wise to get their sleep schedule, their eating schedule, to feel their legs under them. I think the Seahawks arriving on Thursday was about as late as they could possibly do it. And just as a final, the city of London is fabulous. It's a very eclectic, international melting pot type of city, very vibrant. The food, the people, the energy in the city, the mix of old and new. I mean, how old? These buildings are like 1100 or 1000 BC, and it's still preserved and revered and respected. And how easy does it get around on the underground? Yeah. And all the things. Unfortunately, I didn't drive because I was not that stupid, but some of our Seattle TV people did drive, and that was an experience. But
that's Big Ben, Parliament.
The pub, yeah. I've made that reference a few times as well.
Yep.
Unfortunately, Big Ben had scaffolding around it, so it didn't look like Big Ben. Yep. It looked like Big Ben's little brother.
Broken Ben.
Broken fixing Ben, fixing with an up facelift. One thing, though, was two things curious to people that are listening that you may not know about Britain. Pubs close at midnight. Well, what's up with that? I mean, you were getting kicked out at 11:30. It was shocking.
Yeah.
And the reason is...
Not like Pullman on game day week, I'll tell you that.
Do you know why the pubs close at midnight? Because they open at 9 a.m. They're pouring at 9.
Yeah.
And a
little Guinness with your cornflakes.
The other thing that was interesting, they don't have televisions in the pubs. It's not sports bars. You don't sit around and watch England footy on the pub TV. You stay home and watch it with your friends. You don't go out to pubs to watch it. I stumbled into an Irish bar, non-English pub, and saw the end of the Washington-Oregon game at 1 in the morning on Saturday just because it was an Irish bar.
And they were all wondering why you're watching that.
There were a few people watching that, actually.
Yeah, okay.
were a few people watching it. So, and a fabulous experience. Loved it. I hope I told the NFL guy that was there representing the league, you need to have an NFL team in London and you need to put it in the NFC West, and we go over there once a year.
Well, I think it's interesting, the league's kind of vision on this. My father, I grew up in an avid football family. My dad loves football, and he was living in Germany for 10 years as a computer programmer for the Army back in the mid-80s. And the first London Bowl was 1986, featuring the world champion Chicago Bears and the Dallas Cowboys, obviously marquee names, and it was successful. I was actually there for the second one, which was Rams versus Broncos in 1987. And my dad, through all those years, he just had this desire for the American game to be embraced by the world. He says, you know, if we expose the world to this game, everybody's going to love it, because they're going to love it a lot more than soccer. Right. And so, you know, I think there's people in the NFL offices. I only reference him because it's, I think, relevant to the thinking in the NFL that if we expose it, that there's some markets that could be, who knows, untapped, that could produce, how it could expand. So now, as Greg's talking, in 1987, it wasn't like that. Then I went back in 1993. I was with the Cowboys, actually started that game against the Lions, and I felt like there was more than there had been in 87. Now, fast forward here, you're talking about 85,000 people. I didn't get that sense. I don't think that the telecast did a great job of pulling that out.
Mm-hmm.
But it you know, I don't know if it's the foothold that a lot of people thought back in the mid-80s, but it's certainly graphing on an upward incline. And if you're talking about the possibility of a London team, that could then lead to maybe a team in continental Europe. I mean, I think that, again, it's graphing upward. Who knows where it's going to go, but the league's got to be on some level excited about it.
The availability of the product is so much different now as well. The globalization of, the ability to see stuff. It's the same way in reverse with the English Premier League here and some of the soccer leagues from Europe, that now you can watch that stuff here on the regular as much as you want and be able to get that stuff from, Bundesliga in Germany and La Liga in Spain and, all these soccer leagues in Europe. You can now watch and see that you couldn't see that 20, 25 years ago regularly. I mean, I've become an avid, F1 fan watching, stuff in Europe.
You're the guy.
That, you could see him live at 4 in the morning on, you know, ESPN or, you know, Speed Channel back in the day, early. But it's so much more available to you. And it's the same way in reverse now that Europe can see NFL games regularly. And it's just, it's the same way the NBA's gotten huge in China. The globalization of the sports is so much more available to you, and I think that's kind of speaks to it.
Sunday's game was on the BBC, which is over the air to a certain extent. You have to pay a tax in Britain now to get the BBC. You can't just put up an antenna and get it. And but interestingly, it was also on Sky Sports, the cable Murdoch's outfit. So there were two networks covering the game, in addition to Fox here in the United States. No commercial breaks in the BBC. The games went, when the timeouts came on, they had a panel. UC Umunora, can't even pronounce his name, the former Giants pass rusher was one of them.
UC Umunora,
And then the Fox, or then the Sky Sports, Sean Gale, the former Chicago Bears, Ohio State defensive back, was one of the analysts. But they would analyze during the timeouts because there were no commercial breaks. Interestingly, on the BBC, they showed the first hour of the game, but that Sunday at 7 p.m. is time for Matilda and the Sheep or whatever the cartoon was for the BBC. And so if you wanted to continue watching on the BBC, you had to press the red button. There's this thing called a red button on your remote that turns it over into a pay-per-view. And so they always talk about go to the red button, or it becomes red button at 7 p.m.
Did you become a huge fan of Matilda and the Sheep?
No, I was at the stadium, so I missed that episode. I missed Matilda and the Sheep because I was at the stadium.
They didn't have a red button for the Heidi game.
No, they didn't.
They did not.
Good reference.
Yeah.
1968.
Yeah, wasn't it? The Jets and the Raiders.
It was like that, though, the Heidi. Yeah, right. Exactly. It was like a Heidi-type show that the BBC had to continue to show. Yeah, great experience. I could go on and on. I love that place.
Well, there are like three topics I think that we have to get to in this, and so I'll move on to the second of the three and give you guys some opportunity to expand on the big story, the tragedy that befell all of us this week, the loss of Paul Allen and his life. And, Hugh, you were going on and on about how different owners in your own personal experience, how far they came up short in measuring up to this guy. And, you know, I think that it's like he didn't write a book on it, but maybe he did write a book on how to be an owner in sports while he was alive and while he was with the Seattle Seahawks. Because I hear this all the time. Here's what you want from an owner, somebody that is invested, but is hands off, lets his football people do his things, makes business decisions. He's not just an open checkbook, but on the other end, is there if you need the support that you're looking for without thinking that he's the general manager of the team. You hear it all the time. Why are so few able to execute it? Why was Paul Allen able to do it?
You just enumerated a handful of things there. I don't think that you mentioned the most important thing. Hire the right people. Because whomever you hire, let's say you say, you know, I don't know much about football, but I have to hire a president that does, and he does all the hiring. Whatever you're going to do as an owner, it's who you hire. And so those decisions are made because everybody, as I said, is hired by somebody that you hired if you're the owner.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's, in addition, he was a successful owner because, the final product is that's his resume as to how good a owner he was, and this has been a very successful franchise under him, the most successful that the Seahawks have had, right?
Yeah.
So, but all of those other facts are absolutely there, and I would say the only concern that I would have as a Seahawk fan is who's going to replace him, and what's the likelihood he's going to be as good as Paul Allen and
or she,
he or she? Yeah, I beg your pardon. And part of that is we hear these stories about Paul Allen, you know, driving some accountability and these meetings, and there had to have been, you know, in John Schneider and Pete Carroll, when they have Paul Allen saying, "You tell me what's going on here. I'm not accepting 42-7 losses to the Rams," that type of thing. Those meetings and that accountability, I think that they're eminent professionals over there, and I think they keep doing their job. But I just can't imagine that knowing that a owner of Paul Allen's stature is scrutinizing you closely, that had to have been an asset to the franchise.
Well,
it had
to have been. Ultimately, Pete Carroll earned, what was it, 91st victory on Sunday?
Yes.
Which passed Mike Holmgren for the most in franchise history. Both coaches, you know, brought to Seattle under Paul Allen's ownership of the team.
Yep.
Two of his three head coaches have become the two best head coaches in franchise history that he's had since he ran the team. Did he hire Erickson? Or I can't remember.
So,
I
think
two of the last three. Erickson. I can't remember exactly what the timing was on that one. It switched over. But
I think Dave Bowling was saying that he was giving him credit for Erickson being a pretty good hire at the end of Behring's time. So I think that was a Behring hire.
Gotcha. So ownership matters. I mean, if you don't think it does, look at the Washington Redskins.
Sure.
Look at the Cleveland Browns. Look at the New York Knicks. Look at any the early 2000s, late 90s, Los Angeles Clippers. Ownership
Cardinals.
Matters. Yeah. So, I mean, Paul Allen taking over the franchise took a team that had a couple playoff appearances and was on the verge of leaving town and turned it into one of the best five franchises in the NFL over the last 15 years.
And as Greg pointed out earlier this week, and it wasn't even one of the 10 best things that he did in life.
That we've just spoken to Paul Allen for how many minutes, and we haven't even mentioned what he's done for the world.
Yeah.
The world's a better place than when before Paul Allen was born and raised. Changed the world in Microsoft and in personal computing. Changed, philanthropically changed lives, brain research, still neurological pathways he's opened because of his money. And
that will continue.
Exactly. That's his legacy. And this football thing is just a minor speck. I mean, I was reading the Times of London on the flight back yesterday. There was one line in Paul Allen's obituary about the Seattle Seahawks. He was the owner of the Seattle Seahawks that won a Super Bowl in 2014.
Right.
And here we're talking on and on about what a great thing he's done for the Seahawks. You must be a pretty good dude if that's one line in the Times of London's obituary about you.
Right.
And it was about a 5-6 column with a jump talking about how he's changed the world. And it was interesting to view that from that lens, that in the worldwide view of Paul Allen, it's that he has changed and made the world better, in addition to all the things that we're talking about, the football, and the fact that they would be the Anaheim Seahawks without him, period. The offices had already moved. The team was about to move. Ken Behring said the kingdom's going to fall down. I don't know if anyone was here listening can remember that. But the kingdom roof was going to collapse in an earthquake, and they had to leave immediately before the roof fell on them. And the office that had already moved to Anaheim in that 1996 February.
Rand Park.
Exactly. It was the same. It was your
same
old place.
One, yeah, same. I was in that. I got drafted that facility. Yeah.
And he stopped all that. And he said, what do you need to do? Well, we need you to buy the team. Okay. He writes a check. He buys the team. And then they go to the Super Bowl. He tells Todd Lewicki to go to Los Angeles and get this USC coach. And he told Lewicki, through Paul Allen, told Pete Carroll, you can do it your USC way. We're buying your whole program. We're not going to make you the head coach that has to listen to us and tell you what to do. And that is what Pete Carroll will forever be indebted to Paul Allen for, is letting the football guys do the football things, the football ways they wanted to do it. And he was hands-off. That, I think, is the most difficult challenge, whether it's Jody Allen or anyone else that buys the team, how to replicate the involvement that Hugh just described with the hands-off confidence that you do your thing.
And yet he was present. I mean,
he was absolutely present.
Have that many players say how much they loved him if he wasn't some sort of presence in their life.
We saw him in the locker room, win or lose, home and away. He would fly to his yachts off the East Coast when the Seahawks played in the East Coast, and stay on his yacht. Which, by the way, the son of London talked all of it on and about his parties on his yacht. That was the angle of the Paul Allen obituary. The stories of the famous people who have been on his yacht for parties. He was definitely present. He was present. The last time I saw him at a Seahawks function was in training camp in August, mid-August. He didn't look well. It was before he announced that he was undergoing another round of cancer and battling it yet again. But he was there. And he was there for practices and for games, home and away, win or lose. And I told you the story, Chuck, the other day about after that NFC Championship game when they beat the Packers, and saw the players' reaction with him, like one of the guys that I've covered a few pro sports teams. I've never seen an owner be that revered in one of the guys in that locker room like Paul Allen was that day.
Yeah, no doubt. Huge story this week, and he will be sorely missed. All right, we have one more segment with the guys here as our roundtable continues. We're going to have them take a deeper breath and analyze where this team's at right now, 3-3, and in their bye week. Sports Radio 950 KJR.
Available in every state.
Now back to the 12th Man Roundtable, brought to you by Carpet Liquidators on Seattle's original diehard sports station, Sports Radio 950, KJR.
Greg Bell, Furtis Crabtree, and Hugh Millen with us here for a 12-man roundtable on Chuck and Buck in the Morning, Sports Radio 950 KJR. I got one question, but I want to hear all three of your responses to my final question of the roundtable today. So I'll start with you, Curtis. 3-3, chance to take a deeper breath here with a bye week, a little extra time to think about this. Are the Seahawks where you thought they would be at this point? A little better, a little worse? I mean, how do you assess their start to their 2018 season?
I think they're probably a touch under where I thought they could be 3-3 or 4-2. I mean, this is basically what I thought that they could be through the first couple weeks. With the first 2 weeks,
he's a prophet.
With the first 2 weeks of the season, they should be 4-2. You should have got one of those two games, either in Denver or Chicago, to be one game better than where they're at right now. But I mean, I came into the year saying I thought that they were, you know, an 8-10 win team, a team that had a chance to make the playoffs. I still think that that's out there for them. I mean, at this point in time, there's only two teams in the NFC with more wins than they have, so it's a midfield pack that's all bunched together at this point in time. So, you know, they've got you know, some tough games coming up on their schedule still. Games against Minnesota, Kansas City. Stuff like
that.
Even a trip to Detroit.
Even Detroit. That's
going to be an
improving team.
So, but where they're at right now, the one plus side on that is that most of the tough games they have are at home. So, you're going to pull out some of those. Probably better to get them in Seattle. But, so I think they are about where I thought that they would be at this point in time. And, you know, if they had stuck to the kind of blueprint that they'd said they were going to have going into the season, they probably would be 4-2.
Chris Carson was on
the sideline. Not decided to forget the running game for 2 weeks. They'd probably be in a better position than they are now.
Hugh, what do you think?
Well, I think 3-3 is about what I would have expected, because I thought they were about an 8-8 football team. So I think the numbers seem right in that regard. But I think I feel better than I would have thought I'd feel. First of all, I really thought that stopping the run was going to be big to help the secondary. I think they've been pretty solid that way. I think the secondary's played better. I think, you know, Trey Flowers just kind of quietly doing a really good job. I think Tedrick Thompson is playing a little better than I thought he was capable of. So I think that's been solid. But the main thing is the offensive line. I thought there could be several games, you know, at this juncture in the bye. I thought we could well be talking about the same discussion we've had for 3 years, that it just seems to be, you know, spinning your wheels in mud and you're just making no traction on improving the offensive line. I don't think that's the case. So it's a 3-3 football team that obviously is trending up after starting 0-2. I think because of the offensive line, that fact alone would make me feel like the Seahawks are a better team right now than I envisioned them for 2018.
So maybe a little better than 8-8.
Well, I think that they're trending obviously better than 8-8. You know, we'll see how things play out. I'm not entirely convinced on the offensive line, but you know, they played well for a month. You know, a month is not entirely insignificant. So I think that again, I think they're a little better than I would have reasonably hoped for going into the season.
Greg, what do you think?
They're better equipped now than they were at the beginning of the season because of the running game. So they are better off to go springboard from 3-3 than they would have been even a few weeks ago. The problem, it's weird. The problem is I think they're better equipped and are playing a better style to better fit them to succeed, but they're essentially four games out in the division. Three games on the standings, 6-0 Rams, plus the loss they already had to the Rams, plus they have to go to the Rams for the next game in L.A. So you're now talking about a wild card, and you got to get the 10 wins to get the wild card, which means you have to have 7 wins out of your last 12 games, which is attainable. 7-5 would not be what it would have to be. 7-5. My math's right. Wrong. They're 3-3 now.
You'd have to be.
They're going to have to get to seven and three, which is somewhat attainable because the four of the last five are at home. And I told you this at 7:00. I think ultimately what's going to happen with the team, the way they're trending, they're going to continue to run the ball effectively. They are going to regret not running Chris Carson in the opener at Denver and more in Chicago. And they will not, if they don't make the playoffs, it will be because they lost those first two games by not running the ball. They will kick themselves into the next season for not running the ball at Denver and at Chicago, and that ultimately could cost them a playoff spot. But I do think that they are, especially offensively, better equipped to succeed than they were at 1st of September. Defensively, they're better in the pass rush, producing-wise. I know it was against Oakland, and they six sacks against a terrible offensive line. But it was Frank Clark and nobody going into the season, and Frank Clark's been an all-pro type of player the last four, five games. And now you got Quentin Jefferson producing, who no one ever thought would produce. Jerron Reed, who they hadn't seen a lot pass rush-wise inside. They are getting more with less than I think they expected to on the defensive line. That also bodes well for late in the season. It's just, again, the problem is they're four games back in the division.
Yeah.
Well, but the sixth-place team in the conference right now is 3-2-1.
Correct.
Right, as is the seventh-place team, and Seattle's the eighth-place team. So you're half a game.
Correct.
Right?
These ties that are happening.
Yeah, right. I feel like I'm talking about baseball, but they're half a game behind the playoff race. So,
correct.
So we don't expect them to catch the Rams, but I think some of the other teams that you might have thought would be formidable going into
Minnesota,
the year.
Minnesota, for instance.
Minnesota, Green Bay.
Correct.
Right? Atlanta. I mean, there's some teams that you might have thought, obviously the 49ers are far removed. The Cowboys were only 2 years from that 13-3. I mean, there's a lot of teams in the NFC. The Eagles aren't what they were. There's a lot of teams in the NFC, a lot more teams that have fallen off than there are surprises. And even the surprises, teams like Chicago Bears at 3-2, Trubisky's probably still a year away from really maturing enough to be to be formidable in that. I don't know. I just feel like the NFC on the aggregate, if you separate Seattle, the other 15 teams, the NFC isn't what we thought it would be back in the summer. More teams are down than there are teams that are up.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that although 3-3, it's a parallax.
Yeah, there are different ways you could apply that metaphor, sure. Yes.
I like it.
All right, Bucky, man. This is where you come in.
Great stuff.
I don't know what it is either.
12-man roundtable brought to you by Carpet Liquidators. Shop Carpet Liquidators. Their warehouses are full of name brand carpet and floor, including Mohawk Smart Stand Silk, the most durable and easiest to clean carpet on the planet, all in stock and ready for immediate installation. Carpet Liquidators, locally owned and operated since 1988 with six Western Washington locations. Greg Bell, Curtis Crabtree, Hugh Millen, thanks as always. Great stuff, gentlemen.
Thank you. Which side of the road do you drive on again? I'm a little confused driving.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. I got honked at on I-5 for going the wrong way.
You wouldn't be the first.
It wouldn't be the first to go wrong way.
That's right. All right, coming up next, in case you missed it, Rick Neuheisel on game day in Pullman and the Washington Huskies season.